This is Raviona Reis on July 20th, 2017. Something about it's about machloket. Raviona Reis, July 20th, 2017. Women's issue in machloket.
There is a second page of the tshuva over here. It was this side, this one was not.
Ronnie, is it ready? Is it on? I will. Ronnie, is this on? No, I know this is on. Ronnie? Okay. Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight to this evening's shiur, presented as part of the community-wide Beit Midrash program for Givat Sharet. The goal, as hopefully you know now, is to have noted Rabbanim and Rosh Yeshiva come into the community from outside and deliver shiurim approximately once a month in the various shuls in the neighborhood. I want to thank the sponsoring organizations for enabling this program to happen throughout the year. Beit Midrash Torah Lumi, Ol Yonah Menachem, Netzach Menashe, Beit Knesset Feigenson, Kilat Nofei HaShemesh, Garvin Yachad, and Yeshiva University in Israel. In addition, I want to thank all the members of the committee for their help in making this event possible. And before we go on for a second, I just want to let everyone know, please save the date next Friday, July 28th. We are privileged to have Rav Svi Sabalowski, who will be giving a shiur next Friday morning, part of Kol Yom Shishi, on the topic of Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, similarities and differences in halacha and machshava. That's after the 15 minyan next Friday. Please visit our website, beitshemeshtorah.org, where we have announcements, Marim Makomos, and recordings of all the shiurim. Of course, the shiur will be on the site as well, beitshemeshtorah.org. At this moment, I ask you to please turn off your cell phones and hold all your questions at the end of the shiur. After the shiur, we will have a kibbutz in the Beit Midrash in the back as well, and there'll be a mariv at 9:30 somewhere. Hopefully, somewhere here. Tonight's shiur is sponsored by Mrs. Marion Reis and family in commemoration of the yahrzeit of Mr. Harry Reis, Zechor Levracha, Father Rabbi Yonah Reis, Linda Willicki, and Wendy Schindler. May his neshama have an aleha. Now I'd like to ask Rabbi David to introduce our Reis.
In last week's Parshat HaShavua, the Torah describes the succession or successor to Moshe Rabbeinu, Yehoshua ben Nun. The language of the pasuk is rather striking. Vayidaber Moshe al Hashem lemor, Yivkor Hashem Elokei Ruchot l'chol basar, Ish al ha'eda. So Rashi, in a famous comment, notes, Elokei Ruchot, Lama ne'emar, Amar lufanav, Ribono shel Olam, Galu v'yadu lufanecha, Dato shel kol achad v'echad, Ve'inam domim zeh lazeh. Menei aleihem manhig, She'yisovel kol achad v'echad lufi dato. The manhig that should be appointed should be someone who is balanced, someone who has the ability to navigate the shoals of each individual of all different proclivities and the like. In other words, Yehoshua ben Nun, besides the fact that he was the one who ministered to Moshe Rabbeinu, Mishameshet Moshe, as Chazal described in the Midrash, Notzar Teina Yechal Pirya, but had this uncanny ability to be sensitive to the sensibilities of all Jews. And that is not a simple matter. Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal often commented on the Rambam, the beginning of the Hakdama to Mishnah Torah. The Rambam notes that Yehoshua, Shaya Talmidosh Shem Moshe Rabbeinu Masal Torah Shebal Peh V'Tzivaru Aleha. And the Rav referred to a Midrash Chazal that indicated there were other personalities who intellectually may have been of greater acuity than Yehoshua ben Nun. Elazar u'Pinchas Hayu Yoter Mimulachim MiYehoshua ben Nun. So why was he chosen? So we know Elazar and Pinchas, we see them actually as Kanaim in different roles, even though the Torah actually clearly sanctions the Kanaut of both Pinchas and Elazar. But Yehoshua ben Nun somehow had this capacity, beside the fact that he was Mishamesh, Moshe Rabbeinu, had the capacity to somehow provide a balanced kind of perspective on life, and that type of manhig is the ideal manhig. Whenever I see Rabbi Reis, that's what I see in front of me. I see in front of me an individual, beside the fact that he was Mishamesh Gdolei Yisrael, that he was able to literally minister to great Gdolei Yisrael and studied by them and learned by them, but he himself has a very unique kind of approach. Besides being a lawyer by trade and a dayan and someone clearly who has served in many capacities in the course of the last several decades on behalf of Klal Yisrael, and today occupies the position of the Av Beis Din of the CRC in Chicago, but clearly one of the Rashi Yeshiva of Yeshivas HaBnei Yitzchak Elchanan, and someone who's heavily involved in contemporary issues. But all this, he approaches, number one, with an academic perspective, a scholar of renown, a great Talmud Chacham, but above all, l'fi aniyut dati, the sense of balance that he brings to the fore regarding these issues. He is literally, perhaps one can characterize him as a kind of Yehoshua ben Nun, a manig Baruch Hashem that was zochet to have in our midst, and it's a great pleasure to have the honor of Rav Yonah Reis.
Thank you very much. It's a tremendous honor to be introduced by Rabbi David Shlita, and a tremendous kavod to be able to speak in Rabbi David's presence. And I want to thank Rabbi Thal for organizing this event as well. Rabbi Thal and I go back many years, many decades. I believe that we were smicha students together once upon a time at Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. He's gone on to great and wonderful things. I was asked to speak about women rabbis. People thought that would be an interesting topic. Truth is, I give a shiur every year at Yeshiva University, at Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, on the subject of contemporary roles of leadership for women in the Jewish community. So I've spoken about that subject. You have in your materials Samara Mekomos. You have a tshuva that I recently wrote on this subject as well. But I wanted to speak today about not only the it, but also the about it. When we discuss this topic, sometimes it generates a lot of heat, generates a lot of passion. There was a recent statement that was issued by a rabbinic panel that was put together by the OU, by the Orthodox Union, to speak about what roles are appropriate for women in the Jewish communal sphere nowadays. And after that statement was issued, there were headlines in various newspapers, OU comes out against women rabbis, as if somehow we always had women rabbis for thousands of years, and now the OU suddenly came out against it. So there's a lot of confusion, and there's a lot of distortion, and there's, I think, a lot of unnecessary tension. So that's why, when it came to providing a title for tonight's discussion, I tried to come up with some sort of a rhyme, avoiding gender fender benders, that it's about navigating the communal conversation regarding women's leadership roles in halacha. How do we navigate the discussion? In the course of discussing the navigation, I'll try to go through some of the sources, but I don't know that this will necessarily be an exhaustive review. I think what I have in mind is more of providing a sense of perspective. So first of all, we're in the 3 weeks right now, and during the period of the 3 weeks, a major emphasis is to try to remedy and rectify the sin of Sinas Chinam that brought about the destruction of the second base of Mikdash, and we try to remedy it by providing Avas Chinam, by having a constructive and having respectful discourse. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos distinguishes between Machlokes Shi L'Shem Shemayim, that's Sofa L'Hiskayim, and Machlokes She'ena, L'Shem Shemayim She'en Sofa L'Hiskayim. Machlokes is a difficult word to define, but the Mishnah indicates sometimes it could be good, sometimes it could be constructive. When it's good, it's healthy discourse. You could describe it as healthy disputes. When it's bad, I would define Machlokes as strife. It's strife for the sake of destruction and devastation where nobody wins out. That's the Machlokes, as the Mishnah says, of Koach Va'adaso. What was it that made it a Ein Sofar L'Hiskayim? So the Baal Tanur explains, because Koach V'chol Adaso, they got swallowed up by the earth. So you don't want to have a Machlokes where everybody is going to end up getting swallowed up. You want to have a Machlokes that leads to a Toelis, that leads to a positive and constructive result, where it's a Mitzvah's Talmud Torah to examine both opinions, just like in the case of Hillel v'Shammai. We paskin like Hillel, but if you study the opinion of Shammai, you still get a mitzvah's Talmud Torah. It's interesting, the Mishnah, the Medrash, a couple of weeks ago in Parshas Korach, the Medrash says, Abba Nikra Mishoim, that there are four different types of people that are called wicked. Now this is interesting, because the various psukim are cited that describe different types of people as Rishoim, including primarily it's Parshas Korach, so it describes the Adas Korach, Suvu Nami Ala Leha Anashim HaRishayim HaEle, those who fostered the Machlokes against Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen, so they are described as Rishayim. So the other descriptions of Rishayim in that Medrash, I think, are really referring to other types of Rishayim that also bring about an atmosphere of Machlokes. There are Rishayim, like those people of Chayim Malkus, Bayam Bina Kosa Rasha, those who Chai Misa, Shehu Rasha Lamus, but here we're speaking about Rishayim, I think, that bring about a state of unhealthy Machlokes. So one type of Rasha described is somebody who is Poshet Yodo Lachavero Lahakoso, somebody who lifts up his arm against his fellow to strike him. Second type is Lovevenu Mishalim, somebody who borrows money and doesn't repay it. Third type is somebody who's mishiyeshlo azus panim beinam ispayesh lepnei mishigadol mimen, somebody who is very brazen and does not have any kind of embarrassment or reverence, for that matter, with respect to those who are more senior and those who are more qualified than and accomplished than they are. So when we break these down, we realize that these are the sources of what leads to unhealthy disputation and dispute within our community. Poshet Yad L'Chavero is referring to when a person has a particular position when it comes to a matter of communal import, and they don't try to understand the other person's point of view in a respectful and in a sensitive and in an amicable fashion. Rather, they're Poshet Yad L'Chavero. That's why the Gemara says, L'Chavi Yushalayim, Yushalayim was only destroyed al-Shidonu Din Torah. It was destroyed because everybody judged according to Din Torah. So the Gemara asks, is that such a bad thing? You're supposed to follow Din Torah. You're not supposed to follow the laws of the nations or some type of pagan system. You're supposed to follow the laws of the Torah. So the problem is, essentially, what the Gemara says is, no, the problem is that everybody was taking everybody else to a Din Torah. Everybody was running to the courthouse saying Yikov Adin Sahar, that they wanted to get every single last penny that was owed to them, and they did not try to resolve things in a spirit of compromise. Ela Sheham, Ela Al Shehamidu, Divrei Mazora, below Asu Lifnim Mishira Sadin, that they wanted to follow the strict letter of the law rather than trying to engage in a spirit of compromise and of a settlement. Second type of attitude that leads to machlokis is halo v'veinu mishalim. What's lo v'veinu mishalim? Somebody borrows money and doesn't pay it back. What's that really referring to? So you look in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos again, describes that the Talmidim Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai were each asked, what is the proper midah that a person should be yidrak ba ha'adam, that a person should cling to, and what's a proper midah shiswachik ba ha'adam? And all of the Talmidim came up with some sort of a principle and the opposite. A leib tov, a leib ra, an ayin tov, an ayin ra, shakin tov, a shakin ra, chavit tov, a chavit ra. And there was one Talmid who came up with two different ideas that seemed to be just completely in different worlds from each other. That's Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon said, well, the good midah is haroes anolat, somebody who looks thoughtfully into the, what's going to happen in the future and plans accordingly. And the bad midah is lo v'veinu mishalim, somebody who borrows and doesn't pay back. So it seems lo v'veinu mishalim is the flip side of an individual who's not roes anolat. I mean, somebody borrows money and they don't realize that they're not going to have the wherewithal to pay it back, and it's going to lead to machlokas later on. The Gemara in Baba Metzia at the end of Perek Ezu Neshech talks about how Rav Ashi once asked for a loan from Ravina, and Ravina said, I'm not going to give you the money unless we record it in a shtar and we have witnesses. And Rav Ashi says, well, you don't even trust me. He says, well, you're so busy with your learning all the time. It's not that I don't trust you. You're going to forget about it, and then it's going to lead to machlokas later on. That's what leads to lo v'veinu mishalim. You're not roes anolat. So it's the same idea. We have to think down the line of what our positions and what our statements are going to lead to. And it's very, very important not to draw lines in the sand. If those lines in the sand are lines that we're not ultimately going to be able to stick to, and that's going to result in unnecessary tension. As President Barack Obama learned, that you can't always come up with an ultimatum and say, well, if this happens, then I'm surely going to war. And then it'll happen, and you realize it's not such a good idea to go to war. So you have to be very, very cautious in terms of your wording, in terms of the positions that that you take. And finally, Mishieshlo Azus Parim. This is one of the biggest problems that we have. The when we're dealing with major halakhic decisions that affect the future of Klal Yisrael, and especially when we're dealing with the potential of change in the community, it's very important that it be done in the same atmosphere and in the same spirit in which we receive the Torah in the first place. At Har Sinai, Be'ema V'yir Areses U'Vizeh, that it has to be with a sense of trembling, a sense that we're dealing with the Torah over here. And if we think that it is appropriate, because we're living in a changing world, to have certain changing paradigms, then we have to consult with the Gedolim, we have to consult with the great poskim within our midst, we have to consult with the Baalei Mesorah, so that we make sure that there is a proper sense of not having Azus Parim and being Mispayish, means Shegado Mimenu, that you can't have these decisions made without that type of consultation and without that type of analysis. While on the one hand, there has to be respect and deference given to new generations, that you're supposed to be Noach L'Sishkores, but before you get around to being Noach L'Sishkores, you have to be Havei Kal Harosh, as Rabbi Shmuel says in Pirkei Avos. You have to be Kal Harosh, you have to understand, you have to be deferential to those who have the expertise and those who have the halakhic knowledge. And finally, the last of the four different categories, which are enumerated in the Mishnah, in the Medrash, on Parshas Korach, about the Arba Nikraim Mishayim, is of course the most obvious category, which is people who are Baalei Machlokas. It's Baalei Machlokas. Those are the people who are just looking for fights, that they like sensationalism. They like to say, ah, look, we have a major machlokas in the community. It's something that stirs them up. It's something that riles them up. It's a reason to go to Shulchan Shabbos. It's something to talk about, something that you can get passionate about. So that can be a very, very destructive force, to be a Baalei Machlokas. You look at the Gemara, it talks about what is the true meaning, where the Torah says, lo yechikoach v'chadoso, that you should not be like Korach and his Eda, meaning what? You shouldn't be machzik b'machlokas, meaning that sometimes, unfortunately, machlokas and non-constructive machlokas can happen. Can happen when people carve out positions that are too extreme to begin with, when people don't engage in respectful discourse to begin with, when people don't follow the proper protocols of consultation with Poskim and Gedolim before deciding to do things on their own. But after all is said and done, and after you've reached that point, it's very important, like Moshe Rabbeinu, when it came to Dasan of Aviram, that you can't be maxik b'machlokis. There still is the opportunity to make amends. It's never too late to try to have a rapprochement, to try to have a meeting of the minds, and to try to talk and listen to the other side, and simply try to find common ground in terms of resolving these types of issues. And that's really the starting point, that we have to recognize that we are fundamentally all in the same camp. We're all ma'aminim, b'nei ma'aminim, v'ein lanu, amili she'ein el avinu shebashamayim, as Mordechai Ben David so beautifully sings, that we are all believers in the truth of the Torah. We're all believers in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're all believers in the importance of following Ratzon Habore. If we all go in with that attitude, then there really is no need and there is no reason why any subject, even if it's a difficult and a thorny and a challenging subject such as women's roles in the modern age, there's no reason why that should have to generate any tension whatsoever. As long as the halakhic process has been properly followed, we can all feel that there is a confidence level that it will be a sofa l'hiskayim in the most positive and in the most constructive possible way. So the reality is that yes, the world around us is changing. It's not exactly the same world of our fathers, of our grandfathers, grandparents of 200 years ago. So to deny that would be contrary really to what the Torah expects of us. The Torah expects us to adapt to new situations and to new realities. But at the same time, of course, the Torah itself is immutable. The Torah itself is unchanging. That is one of the Yud Gimel Ikari Amunah that is postulated by the Rambam, that the Torah can never actually be changed. So what we always have to do is just figure out how to plug in the principles of the Torah to brave new worlds, to constantly changing situations. We always have said from time immemorial, Shoin, it's a different world, right? I think there was a writer for the Jewish press, he wrote that all the time, Arnold Fine, Shoin, it's a different world, I think. So yeah, Shoin, it's a different world, and the world is changing at a very, very rapid pace. But the question, and we've had to adjust principles of Torah to new realities in technology, in medicine, in science, and for that matter, in sociology. But we're certainly up to the task. The very, very last statement that the Levush makes in his codification of Halacha, the Levush, of course, was the Talmid of the Ramah, and the Levush has commentaries on all four Chelkei Shulchan Aruch. So when he got to the very end of his codification of Orach Chaim, the very, very last statement, really the very end, like the last thing that Levush throws in, is he says, you know, we have a different world right now. And it used to be that if men and women would sit together at a Sheva Brachos, they couldn't make the bracha of Shesimcha B'mona because it was a lack of tznias. But nowadays, you can make the bracha of Shesimcha B'mona when men and women sit together at Sheva Brachos. Why? Because we live in a different society nowadays. He was speaking, what? I don't know, 16th century. So he said, nowadays, that men and women are so used to seeing each other all the time. It's not as if they're constantly closed off from each other. It's a very regular thing. So therefore, it's not considered to be some sort of a lack of tznias, or some sort of a startling or astonishing thing if a man is going to make a bracha of Shesimcha B'mona in the presence of a woman, and therefore it should be completely permissible. So this is really the heter for mixed seating at weddings. So sociology, we see, changed 400 years ago, 500 years ago, and therefore the halakha had to also adjust for the change in sociology. Now, of course, the sociology has completely changed back, and it'll be unthinkable for men and women to like see each other ever, but at least at that point in time, so it was moving in that particular direction. So you always make changes according, it's not that the halakha changes, it's just that the sociology changes, and the halakha has to accommodate the sociology. So we can certainly handle this. We're not dealing with a situation where, chas v'shalom, there's been some terrible scandal, Where somebody has done something totally wrong and we're embarrassed to confront it. No, it's a happy reality. We're living in a time in which there is higher education, more generally available for women than there was 100, 200 years ago. The Chafetz Chaim already wrote about developing a structured school system, educational system for young girls, the Beis Yaakov system, that had never existed before. And he said, even though there are Mishnayos that talk about not teaching Torah to one's daughter, it might lead to Tiflus, he said that's when all the girls would be able to learn everything in their homes. But nowadays, where that type of education doesn't necessarily happen, and the girls, the young women, go out and they're learning other types of trades and other types of disciplines, and they're not learning Torah at the same time. So therefore, it would be a terrible thing if we don't have a structured educational system to teach Torah to girls, to teach Torah to women. But Yosef Dov Soloveitchik took it even a step further, and even though the Rambam drew a distinction between Torah Shebichtav, which B'di'evit at least could be taught, and Torah Shebal Peh, which shouldn't be taught, the Rav Soloveitchik wrote in a letter, so also in the materials, to Rabbi Leonard Rosenfeld, who I think was heading up the BJJ, the Jewish Educational Organization in New York at that point in time, and he was asked, he asked Rav Soloveitchik, how should we structure Jewish education in our schools? And Rav Soloveitchik said it would be a terrible thing if we didn't afford the young women the ability to learn Torah Shebaal Peh, the same way that we teach Torah Shebaal Peh to boys, that they shouldn't feel like they're discriminated against. So how could the Rav have gone against what had been the halakha up until that point in time? So the answer that is explained by various family members of Soloveitchik is that if you look in the way the halakha is codified based on the Mishnah, Gemara, and Sota, is that women have to learn those halakhos that are relevant to what they need to know. They need to learn Hilchos Shabbos because they have to observe Hilchos Shabbos. They need to learn Hilchos Nidah, and so forth and so forth. So women also need to have Yiras Shamayim. If they're going to learn secular subjects on a very high and detailed and complex and comprehensive fashion, and they don't learn Torah in the same rigorous and meticulous way that they're learning their secular studies, so that could impinge upon their Yiras Shamayim in terms of having an appreciation for the beauty and the grandeur of the Torah. So this therefore becomes not optional instruction, but this becomes necessary instruction as well. So there are certainly these changes, and it's not a bad thing. We don't consider the fact that the Beis Yaakov movement had to be created to be a bad thing. I don't think anybody, I haven't seen anyone lament to say, oh, it's such a terrible thing that the world changed and therefore we had to create the Beis Yaakov schools. So too, we shouldn't lament the fact that, Baruch Hashem, now that women are learning Torah on a higher level, there are more women who are qualified to even have this discussion about leadership positions that we even talking about. Oh, is there such a thing as women rabbis or rabbis or maharats or whatever else you want to throw into the picture? So the fact that we're having that discussion, it comes potentially from a good place. The only question is, what do we do with that discussion, and what's the manner in which we approach this conversation in accordance with the principles that don't lead to machlokas and in accordance with the principles that respect the notion of our tradition of to be misbayish, misha gadol mimenu, that it has to be a discussion that is primarily going to be decided and determined by those who are the gedolei Yisrael. It's interesting, if you look in last week's parsha, in parshas Pinchas, about the Benos Tzlavchot. So the Benos Tzlavchot are referred to in many different ways. The daughters of Tzlavchot, we know the story that their father didn't have any boys, only had girls. And generally speaking, if there are boys, so the boys inherit everything, and not the girls. They have to be sustained from the estate, married off, and so forth. Mishnayos and Baba Basra that discuss this. However, when it comes to the Yerusha, the boys receive the Yerusha. So their father didn't have any boys, and therefore they said that they think that they should get the Yerusha. They should get the inheritance. And Moshe Rabbeinu brought their request to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Hashem said, came benos tlavkad dobros. Yeah, they're right. Now, some detail him nachlas b'soch achay avinu, that they should receive the inheritance. And Kadosh Baruch Hu agreed with their particular position. So the Gemara says they were chokmonios. Why were they chokmonios? They were very smart. They were smart because they made good arguments to Moshe Rabbeinu. They said, well, if we don't count for anything, so then our mother should have to do Yibum, because if a man dies without any children, so then the wife has to do Yibum. But the fact that if there's a daughter and not a son, then the wife doesn't have to do Yibum. So they said, so if we don't count, then our mother should have to do Yibum. Obviously, we do count for something, so therefore we should inherit as well. Rashi, Al HaTorah, in his commentary to the Parshas Pinchas, he gives a different explanation, I think based on the Sifri But what made them into Chachmanios? What made them into Chachmanios is Ha'im Hayu Lo Bein Lo Hayu Tovos Klum. They were Chachmanios because they wouldn't have made the claim in the first place had there been a son. So what's such Chachma about that? Why is that Chachma? Had there been a son, they wouldn't have made their claim. I said they come up with a very fancy schmancy argument, so that makes them into Chachma. That makes them into Chachmanios. Why does this make them into Chachmanios? So I'd like to suggest that maybe what made them into Chachmanios is because the Torah is emphasizing, Chazal are emphasizing, that they were acting in accordance with the Chachma as defined by the Torah. They weren't looking to challenge the Halacha. They knew the Halacha is that there are boys, the boys get the inheritance. Maybe they wouldn't be so happy that the boys get the inheritance, but that's the Halacha, so therefore they weren't challenging what the Torah says. But what they were looking for was that they wanted to develop the Torah. What happens if there are no boys? They wanted to explicate the Torah. They wanted to fulfill their destiny within the framework of the Torah. So this is Chachma. This is what made them Chachmanios. This is what we want as well. This is what we celebrate. We don't believe in a Chachma which is outside or independent of the Torah when it comes to defining Halacha. We have to work within the discipline of the Torah. That is true Chachma. So a number of rabbis, including a number of my Rebbeim and Chaverim, worked very hard. They worked very hard as members of this rabbinical panel that was convened by the OU to fashion an approach about defining proper rules and boundaries for leadership. Trying to sort through this whole morass of rabbis, rabbis, maharats, marot, kala teachers, yoratzot halacha, scholars in residence, executive directors, Golda Meir, you name it. But they ended their analysis with what I think was a very appropriate statement. If you look in your materials, very, very last page, at least of the source sheet. So what they said was, in the last paragraph, we seek to follow the values of the Torah, preserve them and embrace them as our guide, which we can only do by respecting our tradition and upholding the instructions and values that emerge from within it. It is with this deep level of engagement with the Torah that we are infused with a sense of purpose and transcendence, and it is through the medium of halakha and Torah ethos that we find liberty and exaltation in surrounding ourselves to the divine will. The way that I understood their statement is that they meant it not only as you might read it yourselves, as a cautionary note to those who might want to push harder and might want to push more aggressively than whatever their conclusions were, but I think especially knowing the people who are involved and knowing their sincerity and knowing their goodness, that they really intended this last paragraph as a note of humility, that we can't engage in this type of conversation without recognizing that ultimately we have to surrender to the will of the Almighty. And we comb through sources and we consult with Gedolim and we try to understand what the Torah is telling us, but ultimately it's to do Ratzon HaBorei. It's to figure out, given changed circumstances, given the realities, given even people's passions of wanting to fulfill certain positions and the like, what is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from us? The same way that a Kohen submits himself to the will of the Almighty in terms of women that he's not allowed to marry. It's the famous story that Rav Soloveitchik told over, really with tears in his eyes, when he told the story of a Kohen and a Gioris who came to him and they wanted to get married and they were deeply, deeply in love. And it was a real love. It was a love on the highest level as could be characterized by the Rambam when he talks about Kenei Lecha Chaver. Was for the loftiest of purposes, but the problem was that the Torah forbids a Kohen from marrying a Gioris. Where Gioris doesn't appear in terms of the Psulei Kehuna, but it's included in one of the Psulei Kehuna. However, it's Darshan, it's a clear halakha psuka. A Kohen cannot marry a Gioris. And the Rav sat down and he heard their pleas and he heard their cries and he just cried together with them. He cried together with them. He said, together, we all have to submit our will to the will of the Almighty. He wasn't angry at them. He understood where they were coming from. But if the halakha says they're not allowed to get married, they're not allowed to get married. So any type of discussion, any type of exploration about doing new things has to be conducted in that spirit. So we have to define what are the issues and what are not the issues. So Moshe Feinstein famously discusses this in his tshuva about whether a woman can be a mashkicha. This is sometimes a difficult context or a difficult frame of reference for us, especially I work in the kashrus world, And perhaps we don't have a sufficient appreciation of just how much of a srora, of a leadership role, it is to be a mashgiach or a mashgicha. But Rav Moshe took it very seriously, and he felt that if you are a mashgiach, that means that you have authority. You have authority over the balabatim, those who are hiring the mashgiach, to say you have to throw out these pots, you have to throw out these pans, you have to not serve this food. So it is a position of authority. And the Torah tells us, some to sima lecha melech, Melech Lomalka, the first page of the source sheets, that you are, when it comes to appointing a king, you can appoint only a male, but you cannot appoint a female to be a queen. So why does that affect the situation of appointing a mashgicha? Because the Rambam extends this exclusion not only from the case of a queen, but he also extends it to any other type of position of authority, of srora whatsoever, that only a male can receive srora, but not a female. And Rav Moshe talks about this, and he says, well, srora is definitely an issue with respect to a woman mashgicha, but he was dealing with a very sensitive case. There had been a rabbi who had been a mashgiach and really helped to support the family for many years. He passed away. He left an almana. And now the almana was certainly qualified to serve in that position, but she was a woman, but it was really necessary for her parnasa. So Moshe said, you know what, sometimes the Torah and certain halakos are presented in a way where there's a certain malleability, there's a certain flexibility, there's a certain ambiguity. And the ambiguity is sometimes purposely built into the system, if I can present it in that fashion. And he said, it's true that the Rambam extends the prohibition of srara to a woman beyond that of a melech and malka and applies it to all other positions. But he points out that there are other rishonim who did not extend it beyond the case of a woman serving as a queen. And he brings various proofs that the Sefer HaChinuch did not hold that way. The Sefer HaChinuch says explicitly that a woman cannot be a melech because a melech below malka, but he doesn't go beyond that. When he talks about a ger, immediately afterwards, he says that a ger, somebody who is a convert, cannot be appointed to any position of srara whatsoever. So clearly he was comfortable spelling out whenever the prohibition of srara extended to any position, but he didn't say that with respect to a woman. And therefore, says Rav Moshe, and he brings proofs that it's not only the Sefer HaChinuch, other Rishonim as well disagree with the Rambam, and they hold that the prohibition does not apply to anything other than serving as a queen, in which case he says that Betzorach Gadol, if there is a tremendous need, like for this poor Almana, there's a tremendous communal need, so then one could potentially, he writes, rely upon the other positions. Now he goes further and he says, we don't really want to do that. What we want to do is be mekayem shita sarama. We want to figure out, okay, we know now that there's a certain amount of flexibility because there are other positions besides the Rambam, but we'll figure out a way to make it work even according to the Rambam, so that we're really giving the woman the position of mashgicha, but in order to avoid the violation of the Rambam, we'll appoint some rabbi who technically and ceremoniously will be the one who is responsible for supervising her activities, but in reality she's going to be doing everything and he's not really going to boss her around because she's so knowledgeable and she is so proficient. But this way we're able to satisfy the Rambam as well. Ramosh is actually a little bit stronger about it. People don't realize, Rav Moshe actually writes in the Tshuvos that when you do have the ability to make an accommodation and at the same time follow the opinion of the Rambam, who ranks pretty high in our halakhic decision-making universe, then you have an obligation, you have an actual obligation to do so. Even though you could have gone against the Rambam, but if it's possible to accommodate the Rambam, so you should accommodate the Rambam as well. So somebody wrote to him, the editor of a Torah journal called Hamaor, wrote a letter to an angry letter to Rav Moshe. He was very, very piqued. He said, as a result of your even letting in to the analysis, the possibility of going against the Rambam and saying that all these other Rishonim didn't agree with the Rambam, so now the Israeli government might just appoint a woman to be prime minister. Or they might have, or the shuls might appoint a woman to be president of the synagogue. All kinds of terrible things could happen. This was the argument that was presented to Rav Moshe, and Rav Moshe said, I don't really understand your argument, Because, number one, if the halakha allows something, the halakha allows it. If the halakha doesn't allow it, it doesn't allow it. When it comes to the government of Israel, they don't ask us their shilos anyway, so I don't really have to worry about that. When it comes to a shul that would be presented with a question of appointing a woman to be the president, so they will clearly go to the Morei Hora of the community, they'll go to the qualified post of the community, those postkim will be aware of the shita of the Rambam, and obviously they're going to reckon with the shita of the Rambam. So you don't really have to be fearful of consequences as long as you are following the spirit of the halakha. But we have to make sure, and this is a very important point, we have to make sure that our predilections come from the right place. So says Rav Moshe, for example, why aren't you worried about a situation where the woman is the only qualified candidate who has Yiras Shamayim? He says that obviously, if I only have two candidates for a position of Svara, and one of them is a woman who has tremendous Yiras Shamayim, who's very, very frum, and it's Tzenua and everything else, and the other is a man who is a kofir, and he's an apikoris, and he violates every single avera in the book, so obviously you should appoint the woman. He said, nobody would disagree with that. Obviously you should appoint the woman. Why do you assume that appointing a God-fearing woman is worse than appointing a heretical man? He says, clearly that's not the case. In fact, if you look in the Halakha Yomis website, I'm not exactly sure, that's, it always has a picture of Rav Avadya Yosef. It's based on the Pesachim of Rav Avadya Yosef. I don't know exactly who wrote this particular piece. It was published in Rav Avadya Yosef's lifetime. So he asked the question, could a woman be appointed a Rosh HaMemshalah of Eretz Yisrael? And the answer that was written on that website, which is in your materials, in the tshuva, was that Badai, if the only person who is a candidate for a Rosh HaMemshalah, who was a God-fearing individual, was a woman. If she is the only one who is God-fearing, who is a candidate for the position, then obviously it's not even a question. At the same time, in a different shuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, he writes about the Nashim She'ananot. Very interesting term. Nashim She'ananot is out of a pasuk in Yeshayahu. I guess you would translate it as trailblazing women. It says there are these trailblazing women who want to volunteer. Mrs. Esther, she has mind grammar. The women aren't obligated to perform. So he says about the trailblazing women, is it okay for them to volunteer mitzvos and do all kinds of things? They're shaking lulav, sitting in the sukkah. They want to do other mitzvos. That Mrs. Esther, she has mind grammar. So he says they could do pretty much any of them. A couple for technical reasons, like wearing tefillin, that the woman can't do because of gufnaki, etc. But as a general rule, they'd be allowed to volunteer mitzvos. But they have to make sure it's coming from a sincere place. That even though Rabbeinu Tam says that a woman can volunteer, Mrs. Esther Shizman Gwam, even make a bracha, nonetheless, in order for a woman to do so, she has to make sure she's not just doing it because she feels like she's discriminated against and she's making some sort of a feminist statement, because the Torah, one has to recognize the Torah does not actually discriminate against women. Women have the same level of Kedusha as men do. Says, Kosam ala Beis Yaakov v'sagei l'bnei Yisrael, v'tem t'yuli mamlekas konim b'goy kadosh. She was stated both to Beis Yaakov and to b'nei Yisrael, both to the women and to the men, that you are a goy kadosh. So they both men and women, have the same level of Kedusha, have the same level of holiness. And a person has to make sure that what they want to do within the framework of Torah is not coming from sensibilities that might come from foreign influences. So you can't be influenced by secular or Western notions of misogyny. Plenty of notions of misogyny that are out there in the Western world, and one has to make sure that their misogyny is coming from a good place. Obviously, we don't believe in misogyny, but they have to make sure that if they think that a position is not appropriate, it's not coming from some type of a secular notion of misogyny, which we don't believe in, as Rav Moshe points out. And at the same time, they also have to make sure that their objectives are not based on furthering secular notions of egalitarianism either. Because, as Rav Soloveitchik points out, that we clearly do have in the Jewish tradition, when it comes to Dvar Moshe B'Kedusha, etc., there are different roles that are played by men and women. So therefore, the starting point of the analysis is that Bein L'Kula, Bein L'Chumra, one has to make sure that their own predilections and their own predispositions are not being unduly influenced by foreign forces. So one notion that has to be reckoned with is Kofavud Vas Melch Panima. This notion of tznius, that whenever there's a role to be played by Jewish women within our community, so we do believe that there is this desideratum of Kol Kavud Basmach Penima, that's supposed to be followed, the glory of a woman is to conduct herself with modesty and with privacy. On the one hand, it's a very beautiful and heartwarming notion. On the other hand, it can sometimes also come across as stifling and constraining, potentially. I mean, it's interesting because I think Chazal recognized this. The Gemara in Eruvin, and you know, there are certain Gemaras which you're almost reluctant to mention because you're afraid that it might, you know, spark controversy. On the other hand, if it's a Gemara, it's a Gemara. So the Gemara in Eruvin talks about Eser Klolos, that Chava was Niskala, Eser Klolos Niskala Chava, that there were 10 different curses that Chava received when she committed the sin of the apple, whatever, the Eitz Hadas. So one of the curses that's described in the Arabic, in the Gemara in Arabic, is Chavusha Beis Asurin, that she's locked up in a prison. Locked up in a prison? What's that all about? Locked up in a prison. And she can't go beyond a certain point. So Rashi explains, yeah, Chavusha Beis Asurin, because it says Kavud Bas Melech Penima. Kavud Bas Melech Penima. So this pasuk in Tehillim that talks about the glory of a Jewish woman is to be like a princess who is in her home and who's not in the public sphere. So that's supposed to be something which is very, very beautiful. But sometimes, that's what I think Rashi is conveying in the Gemara in Eruvin, sometimes it can feel like Chavusha Beveis Asurin. Sometimes it can feel like a klala. But at the same time, this is a notion that we have to reckon with. And just like the Gemara in Eruvin derives the halacha that Moabis, that Rusk was allowed to convert and get married. She was allowed to get married within the Jewish people. She was allowed to marry Boaz, even though the Torah says that Moabi convert is never allowed to marry within the Jewish faith. So why was she allowed to get married? Because the prohibition against the Moabim was because they didn't, the men, when the Jews in the Midbar were passing through the land of Moab, the men did not go out and they didn't bring lechem u'mayim. They didn't bring bread and water to take care of the Jewish travelers. So the Gemara says that this was not something that the women could be criticized for. Why could the women not be criticized for it? Because because it's not derech ha'isha, it's not the proper, for it's not the general course of conduct for women to go out and to bring in the public sphere the bread and the water. So the Gemara asks, yeah, but the Moabi women could have brought it to the Jewish women. So the Gemara answers, that was a good question, but kokavu de bas melech penima, the Jewish women wouldn't be available. They wouldn't be out there in the public sphere. They would be inside of their tents, they would be inside of their homes, and they wouldn't be available. And therefore, you couldn't criticize the Moabi women for this, and that's why the Moabi women were not punished with this halacha of not being able to marry within the Jewish people once they would convert. That's how Rusk was able to marry Boaz, and it was from this principle of kavud bas melech penima, that can sometimes come across potentially as oppressive or as constraining, that Malchus Beis David was brought about from the union of Arusa and Boaz. It all stemmed from this principle of Kol Kavud Bas Melech Penima. So what about women rabbis? Okay, so let's get about to women rabbis. So what about women rabbis? So the whole discussion of the whole question of women rabbis to some degree is a bit of a red herring, because if you look in source 3, in the Mara Makomos, you see that the idea of the rabbi and of being called a rebbe, of being called a rabbi, so this really stems from smuchin. It stems from those people who would receive smicha, and they would become dayanim. If you take a look at the Rambam, source 10, the case that he has smicha. What is smicha? That's how we make somebody a rabbi. The case that he has smicha to us, lo shi yismichu yedan arosh hazaken, not that we put our hands, literally, figuratively, on the heads of the person who's being ordained. El shikorin lo rabbi, we call them rabbi. Rabbi, rabbi, rabba. The omim lo, and we say, hare at samuch, you are samuch. And what does it mean to be a samuch? It means that you're qualified to be a dayan. So I ask, is a woman qualified as a woman according to halacha? Is she able to be a dayan or not? Whatever the reason, a woman is psula ladun. It's a pithy, succinct, three-word halacha in source 12. Isha psula ladun. A woman does not sit as a dayan. Maybe because she can't be a witness. That anybody who is disqualified, anybody who can't be a witness can't be a dayan. Yerushalmi learns from a different source. Whatever the source is, a woman cannot serve as a dayan. And therefore, the whole reason why we have this institution of rabbi is meant to be a continuation of the original tradition of having the rabbis who were smuchin from Moshe Rabbeinu. And as Tosfos points out in a couple of places, we have this idea of shlichusayo de kamaika of dinan, that even though we don't have the original smuchin from Moshe Rabbeinu, nonetheless we are considered to be the agents in time of those original rabbis. And that's why we have the title of rabbi altogether. Otherwise, we would just call it community leaders. We come up, spiritual leaders, we would come up with some other description. But we retained this title of Rebbe, this title of rabbi, in order to demonstrate that there still is a place for Bate Din, for rabbinical courts. There still is a function of the Jewish court system that can be applicable in this day with Dayanim, even though we don't have the original smuchin who received smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu. So if you understand it in that context, it's really, I think, self-defeating on some level and misleading to focus the discussion solely on the notion of women rabbis, because I think there's a technical disqualification. I remember once I got a call from a reporter. There was a reform rabbi, I think, in southern New Jersey, who had performed a lot of intermarriages. He put up some type of advertisement that he was prepared to perform intermarriages between Jews and non-Jews, and people came flocking to him, and they were very excited that somebody was willing to do it. Now it's not as hard to find people anymore. But in those days, it was hard to find a rabbi to perform an intermarriage, and he performed marriages for, 50, 100 intermarried couples. And then it turned out he was a fraud. It was a lie. He didn't really have rabbinic ordination after all. Whatever Reform Seminary he claimed to have ordination from, they never gave him ordination. He wasn't really ordained. So there was a panic. So all of these couples were in a tremendous state of panic, because they weren't. Maybe they're not married after all. So the reporter who was covering the story called me up. I was at the Beis Din. Called me up and wanted to know, what does halacha have to say if the rabbi wasn't really ordained? Is the marriage still considered to be valid? So it's one of the few times I just did not return the call, because I wouldn't have known where to begin. It was such a ridiculous and a nonsensical notion. So when we speak about, can a woman be a rabbi? So we have to really clarify terms. Do we mean, can a woman be a reform rabbi? Do we mean, can a woman be a real rabbi in terms of what we mean when we try to preserve a sense of dignity? We try to preserve a sense of meaning. We try to preserve a sense of authenticity with the terms and the titles that we use. So therefore, I think that is really, on some fundamental level, a red herring. But at the same time, this has nothing to do with other types of titles and other types of positions where there could potentially be some wiggle room. What do you have to navigate within that wiggle room? You have to navigate what exactly constitutes a srara. To what degree do we have a need or necessity for a particular role for a woman to play in order to further shmir sesvos and yira shemayim within the community, that it makes sense, like what Moshe spoke about in the context of the mashkichot, to try to carve out some sort of a role? If we do try to carve out some sort of a role, how do we accommodate the position of the Rambam? Because as Moshe said, if you can accommodate the position of the Rambam by making sure that there is a rabbinic authority figure who is overseeing the process, then you have an obligation to do so. How do you maintain the standards of Kol Kibuda Bas Melech Penima to make sure that we don't violate this private role that exists according to Judaism, the private role from which came Malchus Beis Dovri, the private role that we believe is in fact something which is very, very beautiful and is the mainstay of all of our families and is the source of what Bilam HaRosha said when he looked at the modesty of our homes, and he said, Matovu Alecha Yaakov, Mishkan Osecha Yisrael. And finally, also the notion of consulting a Re'ias Gidio Sayach. My Rebbe Rav Shachter wrote a famous article at one point in time when there was the discussion about women's minyanim, whatever you want to call them. He called it Si'ilach Bikvei Hatzot, that you have to follow in the ways of your predecessors. Silach mikvei atzon or iaskid diosayach. When the Medrash says that whenever you have to deal with a vexing or challenging issue, so of course, uchua b'rov yoeitz, you have to, you're not going to do, even if it would be a non-halachic thing, a person doesn't do something of import without proper consultation with experts, how much more so when we're dealing with the Torah, that we have to make sure that there is proper consultation with the experts. And I don't envy anybody who is put on the spot to have to make these determinations. You know, I give my point of view. I don't go over to people and say, Kablu dati, you're obligated to listen to what I have to say. But I think it's useful to listen to what everybody else has to say first and then to advance some sort of a mahalak. When I sat down to write a tshuva on the subject, I shared the tshuva with Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz. I shared it with Rav Herschel Schechter Shlita, Rav Schwartz Shlita too, and Rabbi Wilk Shlita. I shared it with all three of my major mentors when it comes to Psak, and only after they all expressed a comfort level with the thoughts that I had written inside of my essay did I feel I can start circulating it. But I'm really circulating it for purposes of trying to build some sort of an understanding, build some sort of a mahalik, some sort of approach, build some sort of a consensus, because I think that we owe it to each other, and we owe it to the requirement to deal with the changing realities of our community, to really confront this in a sensitive and in a thoughtful fashion. A couple of years ago, I was asked, now I can really get myself into hot water. A couple of years ago, I was asked to speak at the first Yoetzer Halakha graduation that took place in America. There are Yoetzer Halakha here in Eretz Yisrael too. So who are Yoetzer Halakha? Yoetzer Halakha are women who are trained to help to guide other women in the course of Taras HaMishpacha issues. So to me, it was a new title, but it wasn't a new notion. The Gemara talks about the Benos Yisrael being involved in helping to make determinations of how we should abide by Taras HaMishpacha issues. It speaks about the Nashim Sikanios Shebaoso Ador, the righteous women in Egypt to help their husbands navigate through Taras HaMishpacha issues in order to have more children. And this was B'skus Nashim Sikanios Shebaoso Ador Nigali Yisrael Mitzrayim, that we were redeemed in their Zechus. And of course, nobody really considers Kala teachers to be controversial, although they once did. The same editor who wrote the letter to Rav Moshe Feinstein complaining about what he wrote regarding women mashkikot also wrote a piece. I didn't know about this. I was reading, you know, sometimes like between Mincha Maariv, whatever, you'll be in a shul and there'll be these old books like in a bookcase and you pull one out, looks interesting. So it was a book called Encyclopedia HaMaor. So I opened up Encyclopedia HaMaor and I saw the editor. This was in English. You could probably still get this. He had this long article which he was raging about this newfangled institution, this newfangled position that had been created called Kala Teachers. It's such a terrible thing, Kala Teachers. Now the people are going to go to the Kala Teachers instead of the women asking the fathers-in-law what to do, which is what they should do. Even Kala Teachers at one point in time was controversial. So, and I saw that the Rabbanim who were running this training institute for Yoetzer Halakha were Erlich Yirei Shemayim people. So I thought, okay, fine, so I'll go and speak. So some people applauded that, and some people gave me a lot of flack. I discovered it was controversial. So over time, I listened to what some of the objections were. Concerns, slippery slope issues, sorority issues, new title. You always have to be circumspect that if you put out a new title out there, you don't just call it college teachers, you call it something new. So maybe that gives some strength to other people trying to create other titles. So I developed a sensitivity. That's all part of the conversation. That's all part of the discussion. Somebody came over to me and asked, can a woman who's trained as a Yoetzer, and if you look at the OU statement, so they said they haven't developed a consensus with respect to Yoetzer Halakha. They see pluses, they see minuses, maybe it depends on each community. The Rabbanim of that community decide, okay, it's a balanced, nuanced approach. So somebody asked me, if a woman was trained, would she be able to paskin? Would she be able to paskin on a Mara, for example? So there's a whole question, can a woman, a learned woman, paskin? The Piskei Tshuva quotes the Chidah, saying, why not? Learning women could pass is a Tosfos. The talks about Devorah was a Shopetis, aye, but a woman's not allowed to be a Dayan. So maybe it was different. She was appointed the Minah Shemayim. She was a Neviah. But one of the answers Tosfos gives is that she was Melamedes Lehemdinim Kadesh Shiyadunu. She would teach the Dayanim what the Dayanim should paskin, that she would paskin. She would basically paskin. There's a Sefer Chinuch that indicates that a woman can paskin. It's a Shari Tshuva that seems to qualify it a little bit, but there seem to be Shitos out there that indicate that a woman could paskin. So I thought this is a good question. It's a good question. There's a Gemara Nida and Daf Chav that talks about how Yalta brought a Gemara that she wasn't sure about, so they asked why didn't she show it to her husband, Rav Nachman. Nobody asked why didn't she paskin it on her own. Seems like it was assumed that she couldn't paskin it on her own. There's another Gemara that talks about there was a Chareshis, a deaf woman that was very proficient in checking out Maros. So what do you do with that Gemara? So I would ask Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Sets out. I asked Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. This was, I think, the last summer he was alive. I went and I met with Rav Aaron, and I knew that he was somebody who was supportive of the Yotzot Halakha. He seemed to have a favorable position toward this new title, this new function. And I asked him. So Rav Aaron answered me. If you ever spoke to Rav Aaron, he wasn't big on giving yes or no answers. So Rav Aaron, the answer that Rav Aaron gave me was, I know the women who serve as Yotzot Halakha. I know them very well, and it's inconceivable to me that they would pass it on a Mara without showing it to a rav, to the local Bar D'Asra. So it seemed like Rav Aaron felt that was the appropriate course, but I thought it was a good question. On the other hand, you can't just answer these questions if you're going to carve out a new type of position, a new type of title. So you can't just go about it. You can't go about doing it without the proper consultation with Gedolim to be able to navigate what exactly should be the parameters. So I would humbly suggest that, in conclusion, we follow the example of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was approached by the Benos Slavkot, says, "Vayakvev Moshe es mishpatan lifnei Hashem." We should submit to the time-honored protocols and procedures of the halakhic process in a spirit of respect and of avas chinam, construct a dialogue in order to figure out what is the best way for all of us to take advantage of our collective abilities and talents, both men and women, to enhance and to elevate the avas haTorah, the Shmiras HaMitzvos, and the Yiras Shemayim in our families and in our communities, and to perform Ratzon Avinu Shebashemayim. Thank you very much.
Okay. I want to thank Rabbi Reese again for enlightening us this evening, and I want to thank Mrs. Marion Reese and family, the Walicki family, the Schindler family, for being co-sponsors for this evening. And we hope that the learning of Torah will have a lisa neshama for Mr. Harry Reese, Zichron Levracha. Thank you for coming. Please remember that we have 8:15 minyan, 9 o'clock breakfast, 9:15, 9:30 shir. And there'll be Marv right now after davening. Feel free to ask Rabbi or Reese any questions you have. We weren't able to do that now because we have Marv. Thank you very much. You can all go to the back. There's Chult and Kogel in the back. Where's Alan? Alan's running to the back for Chult and Kogel. Not you, Alan Chakwitz.
Both of them?
You can take off.